Good afternoon and welcome to Studio 2. That is the very first time I'll get to say that. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. And Cherry, Philadelphia officials say the water is safe to drink for now. On Friday, over 8,000 gallons of contaminant spilled into a Bucks County tributary called Otter Creek. On Sunday, Philadelphians got word from their city government that they, quote, may wish not to drink or cook with tap water. No surprise, that suggestion sent people scrambling through the grocery aisles, and even now, with assurances that the water is safe through Wednesday, folks understandably have questions.
Yeah, and many remain worried. So we will try to provide some answers and address your concerns this hour. We've got experts and advocates standing by to help us understand exactly what happened and the possible impact on our region. We'll also try to figure out when we'll be able to hopefully put this behind us. We'll take your calls as well. That number is 1-888-477-9499. But first, we're going to take a look at some headlines across the region. And first up is Delaware, and we're talking marijuana.
Yeah, so perhaps this went a little under the radar because people are focused so much on the water situation in Philadelphia. But the Delaware State Senate is voting today on two bills that would effectively legalize marijuana in that state. Last year, legalization efforts failed when Governor John Carney vetoed very similar bills. So that state Senate vote is today. This two-bill package already passed the state House in Delaware earlier this month, Cherry. And so we're moving along toward another confrontation between the legislature and the governor.
Yeah, and the big question is, will Governor Carney veto again? And if he does, whether the Democrats and cannabis advocates will have the political will to override that veto. Democrats in the House claim they do, but we'll see what happens in the Senate. We'll be keeping our eye on that. And speaking of political will, higher education institutions in our area, well, they're building up their political will. They've been unionizing, and it appears to be a trend. Most recently, the University of Pennsylvania, their resident hall assistants, they filed paperwork with the National Labor Relations Board, which is the first step toward seeking an election on whether to unionize. This is a pretty big deal.
It is, and there does seem to be a ferment right now on campuses across our region. Of course, people remember that the Temple University Graduate Assistance Union just got a raise after a six-week strike that got a lot of attention in our region. Not sure if people know that over the bridge, Rutgers University, the union representing adjunct faculty there, has already voted to authorize a strike after 9 months of failed negotiations. This affects adjuncts at all three Rutgers campuses, including Rutgers Camden. And so we'll keep our eye there. Sort of a tidbit that's interesting, 256-year history of Rutgers University, never been a strike. And so that tells you that perhaps something's happening right now that wasn't happening before.
Yeah, people saw the success of Temple. And I got to mention today, there's another meeting to determine, because all of this bubbled up to the surface there, leading to a potential vote of no confidence of several head Temple University officials, including Temple University's president. So lots of politics there.
Yep, there is definitely something going on in the higher education water. Speaking of water, Beach Sweeps report. Down the shore, in the Jersey Shore, Clean Ocean Action just released its 2022 Beach Sweep report, which found significant reductions in the biggest, quote, ocean offenders, plastic straws, stirrers, disposable face masks, plastic bags. So if people don't know about this, it's basically like a census for beach trash. They do it every year. Volunteers collect a bunch of trash. It's not, the purpose is not really to clean up the beach. It's to see how much trash and refuse is out there. And so they just released the results from last year's beach sweep. And there are some positive trends there, which is nice to report. And advocates think this could be evidence that some of the bans on plastics that we've had locally are working.
So pat yourself on the back a little bit. Maybe it's too soon. I don't know.
Yeah.
All those reusable bags we keep in the trunk now could be a good thing. That, by the way, that spring sweep that's coming up now. It's just a couple of days, April 1st.
Right, for next year.
For next year.
And by the way, if you are interested in participating in that, you can head on over to cleanactionocean.org if you want to be one of the folks who's helping with the sweep.
Absolutely. And since we're talking about bodies of water, I got to admit, Avi, water is something I typically take for granted.
We all do.
But then when your water gets messed with, mm-hmm. it's extremely scary. And that's what happened with us. So we're going to zoom in now on the Delaware River and the mess that we've been dealing with over the past few days. And we have Susan Phillips, the energy, environment and climate change reporter here for WHYY to help us parse through all of what happened. Susan, thank you for being here for our very first show. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. Very excited.
Yeah.
So, Susan, people have been getting this news in drips and drabs over the last few days. So what we really want to start with here is have you establish a timeline of exactly what happened. And this starts Friday, right? Friday, there is
an issue. That's right. So Friday, just before midnight, apparently a leak occurred of, and I want to emphasize, estimated 8,100 gallons of a chemical component, because one of the things that I've found in reporting on this for the past 10 years or so is, you know, there's always the first announcement of this much chemical got released. And then when we get to the actual violation that DEP or EPA puts out, it is often, not always, but often more. Okay.
Right. And that's so, at that point, people have forgotten about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yes. So, 8,100 gallons of this liquid, this chemical liquid that's used to make, you know, that's a latex base that's used to make coverings or, you know, corrosion proof coverings for cars and whatnot. It's a very industrial chemical, leaked into the Delaware River. As you said earlier, Avi, it first, you know, went into a storm drain and then went into a nearby creek, which then fed into the Delaware River. And the problem with that is that the city's main intake from the Delaware River for its Baxter treatment plant that mm-hmm. provides a large portion of the residents with drinking water is about 8 miles south mm-hmm. of that plant. So what the city was looking at that point was this white cloud moving down the Delaware River.
Rather ominous
white cloud moving down the Delaware River. What's in it? Will it pollute the water? What, you know, what's happening? So the city's first press conference was actually Saturday evening at 9:30 p.m. And then Sunday morning, you know, late Sunday morning, I guess, we all got the notice where it was like, on your phone.
Yep.
That said, like, hey, you know, a bottled water advisory, which, of course, meant everyone was going to run out and buy bottled water and clear the stores of water, bottled water. And then several hours later, we got the notification that said, okay, don't worry, it's actually safe at least until the next day. So, yeah, go ahead.
Let me just stop you right there, Susan. Explain that gap between there's something happens Friday,
and we
this white cloud
it.
Starts moving downstream, and then Sunday, in this beautiful spring, sunny Sunday, all of a sudden we're getting this very alarming alert.
Yeah.
I know you're not a city official, but I want you to try to explain why there might be that gap there.
I'm definitely not a city official, so I cannot speak for them. But I think one of the things, so I don't know any, you know, I can't speak to their communication. But what I can say is that water, you know, does flow at different rates. And one thing people need to understand is the Delaware River is a tidal river, right? It rises and falls 6 feet twice a day. Below Trenton. So there was also a lot of rain at that time. So what they've said is that the rain helped dilute it. The company said that the rain helped dilute the chemical. Also, if you've got like tides coming back and forth, it's definitely going to, you know, change the flow and provide some kind of dilution as well. So I think what they were doing was testing not just the water supply and the river, but trying to figure out, like, did any of this chemical actually get into the water supply at the Baxter treatment plant in Northeast Philly? And one thing to note is that the reason why they keep postponing this per se and saying it's safe is that, you know, these treatment plants have this big storage basin of water, right? So that they can still treat that water. And then it takes time after that water is treated to get into the mains and then to go into people's homes. And so it's not going to happen right away. If there's a chemical coming down river heading towards the Baxter treatment plant, it's not as if like all of a sudden your drinking water is going to be contaminated, right? So that's what they were watching. They were watching, like, you know, testing and watching the flow.
And so can we go back to the timeline? Because I want us to have a full understanding of the facts. So we get the Sunday notification, and then things shift after people have already panicked.
Right. So there was a buying spree. And then Sunday afternoon, it was like, you don't need to buy water, and you can, you know, we know that the water is going to be safe at least until right before midnight on Monday, the next day, right? And then we hear that, it would be 3:30, right, today. And then the next time it would be the Wednesday night just before midnight. And that's, you know, basically where we're at right now.
Is this the typical way that, folks would communicate a water issue to the public? Can we talk about how this was communicated to folks in the Philadelphia area?
It's interesting that you ask that, because there is this whole issue with risk communication, right? And how do you do that? How do you thread the needle between being super cautious and transparent and not causing a panic? Mm-hmm. And that is something that, you know, academics study and talk about. I mean, one thing we didn't hear from Mayor Kenney until mm-hmm. yesterday. And one of the things I know that experts say is really important to have a known familiar person speak on this to calm people down. One of the other criticisms I've heard as well is other, you know, language alerts, like the Spanish language alert did not come out till long after the English language alerts came out. And what about other language alerts? You know, so there's a lot of questions here on the communication.
Yeah. I want to preface this question by saying we asked the city to make an official available for this conversation. They declined. And so we are having Susan fill in some gaps, and there are some questions that we cannot fill in right now. But you alluded to something earlier, and I really want to put a fine point on this. We keep getting these periodic updates saying the water will be potable, safe until X time. And that is based, from my understanding, on how water treatment works. Just put a fine point on that. Why are we seeing these sort of time horizons continually reset?
Got it. Yeah. So if you think of it this way, you know, like you've got this big giant bathtub of water at this treatment plant that's already there, and it's, you know, designated, I don't know, could last, I don't know exactly how much time, but they know how much time it can last to provide drinking water for people. And so if they're using this water that had been stored before this spill occurred, then obviously it's not going to be contaminated. So already make use of that water, then what they're doing is testing the water that's coming through and seeing if there's any chemicals in the water. And to be clear, they say they have not found any chemicals in the drinking water.
And by the way, I want to read a statement from the company on behalf of the Trencio plant in Bristol. It says, AltaGlass LLC is working with local, state, and federal agencies to clean up the release of a latex emulsion product from its manufacturing facility. The release, which occurred Friday, March 24th, appears to be the result of equipment failure. They mentioned that. And some of the material overflowed the on-site contaminant system and entered a storm drain. They talk about that. They said no injuries were reported. They also said that representatives are on the ground and they're responding on site. We just wanted to make sure that the company's words were represented. Susan, you're going to stick around with us. And coming up next,
we've got a lot more. We're going to talk to a couple experts, advocates, and we're going to take your calls right here in Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the chemical spill in the Delaware River and its impact not just on Philadelphia residents, but our entire ecosystem and water systems. And of course, we are talking to you. We have a caller on the line, and we're going to take your questions. I just want to give you that phone number. We are accepting calls. You can call 1-888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. You could tweet at us and use the hashtag studio2.
And so we want to bring in Marilyn to ask Susan Phillips a question. Susan is an energy, environment, and climate change reporter here at WHYY. And Marilyn, I believe you have a question about the safety of the water where you live. First of all, welcome, Marilyn.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I live in Hatboro, and we got some of our water from, well, most of our water is from wells, but some of it is from the Bucks County Water Authority. So I haven't heard anything about the fact that we might be impacted. And I just, you know, I've been imagining that when we would be impacted would be sooner than Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Because I've been imagining this stuff going down the river.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works.
So talk about the impacts outside of Philadelphia, Susan, and particularly in Hatboro.
Yeah, no, that's such a good question. And thanks for that call, because the water system is, you know, kind of complicated in some respects. And there are different water companies and different water departments. And one of the things that I can tell you, I don't know specifically about Hatboro, but I can tell you that Pennsylvania American Water, which also has intakes up near this spill, did shut down their intake, and they say that none of their water is impacted. Across the river in New Jersey, there's also a plant at Delran, New Jersey, run by New Jersey American Water. And again, same thing. So they have been testing as well, and they say they have found none of the chemicals in their drinking water.
So far, Maryland, you can rest easy for now, at least. So I want to bring in our other guests into this discussion. Susan, you'll stay with us. But joining us now is Maya Van Rossum. She is the Delaware Riverkeeper and founder of Green Amendments for the Generations. Her latest book is The Green Amendment, The People's Fight for a Clean, Safe, and Healthy Environment. Maya, thank you for joining us in Studio 2 today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us is Chuck Haas. He is a professor of environmental engineering at Drexel University who studies water treatment and environmental health. So two very important topics right now. Chuck, thanks to you for coming on our inaugural show.
Thank you.
So we have Chuck and Maya joining Susan. And of course, we are taking your calls, 888-477-9499. I actually want to go back to Susan now, and Chuck and Maya, just stand by. What can you tell us about the plant in Bristol, Pennsylvania that released these chemicals, and how do you parse their statement so far about what happened?
Yeah, so we don't have a ton of details from them, but basically what happened was they say there was an equipment failure that led this chemical to basically go into the storm drain. So my question is, of course, what was the containment? Like, why did this hazardous liquid breach their containment system? Do they have a modern, up-to-date, state-of-the-art containment system? Like, if you drive, like, say, for instance, past the refineries in South Philadelphia or any kind of chemical plant, you can see these big ditches along the roadway. And that, you may wonder why, but that's for containment. That's so that does not get into our water system. The company themselves is it's a major company that produces a lot of different chemical components.
And a brief follow-up there, how reliant have we been on the reporting from this company, and did we have anything in place to do some of the investigation of this initial breach on our own as a city?
Well, sure. So, you know, DEP, I'm sure, is probably that's the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection.
And we should also point out that we did reach out to DEP for an interview. They did initially make an official available for us and then rescinded that offer this morning. So we do not have their perspective on this. But Susan, go ahead.
Yeah. So my guess is that they are leading the charge in terms of the investigation of what happened. Right. And so they have a number of laws where they can hold the company accountable. The question is, what will the violations be, and how much of a fine will the company have to pay? In my experience, the fines are pretty low.
Yeah, and we'll put a pin in that and come back to that later. Again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We want to bring Chuck and Maya into the discussion. And Chuck, if you could just start us with an understanding of how, I think Susan touched on this, how water filtration systems work, how it worked in this, how you proposed that it worked in this instance. And I know that about 60,000 gallons of contaminated water has been collected as far as what we know right now.
Well, I'll start with something you already talked about. I think the Baxter plant in particular is very lucky that the first thing they have is a very, very large water storage reservoir, which is not in the case at all plants. And that really helped the city avoid and may wind up helping the city totally escape the contaminated plume from the Delaware. But when they withdraw the raw water from the reservoir, then it goes through chemical treatment, where chemicals are added to precipitate the solid material that may be in the water, clay and sand and anything else that could be attached to those particles. Then once those larger particles are settled, it goes to filtration to filter out smaller particles and smaller material. Then it is disinfected with chlorine and ammonia. Fluoride is added, and it gets sent out to the distribution system.
Chuck, can I follow up there? We keep hearing about this reservoir that you just alluded to.
Yes.
So help me understand. The city keeps saying that they're letting in water from time to time and then closing the intake. Is that a normal course of events? Would they be doing that anyway, or is that in direct response to the threat posed by the chemicals?
Well, it's both. I mean, in the absence of a chemical spill, they would do that anyway, because one of the things this is designed for is, as you said earlier, we are tidal, and with the tides comes a change in the saltwater concentration, the salinity. And typically the city will work to time their intakes into the reservoir to avoid the highest salinity concentrations of the incoming tide. And so that was a design feature that was very important from the outset with design of the Baxter plant.
And Chuck, they keep telling us at this point that they're opening up the intake to preserve operations and preserve equipment. So give us a sense of how that works. It seems like they need to take in a certain amount of water at certain intervals in order to not risk, I guess, damage to the equipment.
Yeah, if the reservoir levels get too low, it may put a stress on the pumps they're using to pump from the reservoir into the main portion of the plant. So that's probably the rationale behind that statement.
All right. And Maya, I want to bring you into the discussion here. You're the Delaware River keeper. Explain what your network does and how you are usually, or how it would typically be communicated with you and your role in something like a contamination that we're currently dealing with.
So the Delaware Riverkeeper Network is an environmental advocacy organization, and we work throughout the entire Delaware River watershed. And generally, you know, we identify projects, programs, initiatives, decisions, permits, permitting that may impact the river and or that are being violated. And then we engage in grassroots organizing and advocacy to try to protect the river from whatever the harm is. You know, perhaps it's a illegal violation of a permit, or it's a proposed liquefied natural gas export facility or pipeline project or fracking or development. And so we use our advocacy. Sometimes we engage in litigation to try to take on those challenges and protect the river. When there's a catastrophic event of this kind, the role of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network tends to be threefold. One, we are often the first place that people come to, sometimes the general public, sometimes the press, wanting to know what's going on. They're not looking at the Department of Environmental Protection or the Coast Guard or the EPA websites. They know that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network is somebody who's out there looking out for the river. And so they'll call us or contact us. And so we become an information resource for the public, but also for the press. We also become a pathway to share information with the agencies who are undertaking the response effort. People out in the community or fisher folk or boaters are often the first to witness a problem on the river, to witness the white plume that came down Otter Creek and then flowed into the Delaware River. That was a first sign that a problem was happening from the perspective of the public. They'll call the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. We have a pollution hotline, 1-800-8-DELAWARE. People will call. They'll tell us what they're witnessing, and we will help pass that information to the right officials. Often when you have a response like this, people want to volunteer and get engaged, and we help them engage in a way that is helpful and not harmful in terms of the response or their own safety.
And so let's zoom in on this particular incident. What is your role here in this particular incident, and how did things go along the normal route this time?
When there's a catastrophic event of this kind, I am supposed to be on the list of being amongst the first to be called so that we can perform this function of sharing information, disseminating information, making sure that people aren't rushing out to the river in ways that are harmful, but instead are simply being safe and helpful. I did not get that call from the Coast Guard or any agency official when the event happened. And frankly, to date, I have not received that phone call. So that was already right from the get-go in terms of my perspective. When it comes to public engagement and information, that was a very quick breakdown in the public communication system that we've kind of seen play out repeatedly in different ways throughout the last couple of days.
And Maya, let's stay on that topic. We have a caller who I believe has some similar disappointment with city officials. This started as a water safety event, and it still is, but it may be morphing into sort of a PR crisis communications crisis.
Event.
Yeah. And so we're going to bring in Stephanie from Center City. Stephanie, I understand you're disappointed with city officials. Can you elaborate?
I'm probably most disappointed in Kenny. I know that he has stated publicly that he's tired of this job, but unless he's going to stop getting a paycheck every week, then he needs to show up and do it. Secondly, I fortunately don't remember the name of the official that I heard on NPR yesterday, who basically said that all households should have at least 2 days' supply of water, and then when pressed, he couldn't come up with an amount. It's like, well, it's all based on your how many in your household, the cooking, et cetera, which
actually,
I think is just a poor response to a population that is freaked out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Stephanie, we actually have that clip. And the official you're referring to is Mike Carroll, who works for Otis, which is the city agency that oversees water and infrastructure. We're going to play that clip right now. Can we roll that?
Everything we have done to communicate with the public has been done in the interest of both transparency and out of an abundance of care and caution to make sure our people are safe. We may be over-communicating with people, and as a result, perhaps we're elevating folks' anxieties. It's a difficult thing to balance. But in giving this information, we're hoping we're able to build trust with the community so that they can understand the water is safe.
And can we react to this? I wouldn't have a
reaction. Can I jump in on this?
Absolutely, Chuck. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I agree. The risk communication here has been very poorly played. When risk needs to be communicated, it should be communicated by people with the expertise. And with all due respect to Mike Carroll, he comes up from the transportation side of things and really doesn't have a deep knowledge of water. And the commissioner of the Water Department is an attorney. There are people at the Water Department who are top-notch, and it's been disappointing to me that they have not been the ones to lead the charge in terms of communicating with the public what they know, what they don't know, and when they're going to have further information.
And I just want to repeat right there to put another stamp on it that we asked city officials to come on Studio 2 and talk with us today. They declined. We also asked and had secured someone from the DEP to come talk to us. That that response that off, you know, was rescinded today. And so we have yet to be able to sit someone down and ask the type of questions. But we hope that you will send us your questions. We will send them a list of questions from the public. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And of course, our phone lines are open, 888-477-9499.
And I just want to, Stephanie makes a fantastic point, and you do as well, Chuck. I want either Chuck or Maya to chime in and say what you think specifically was missing in this response. What information should the city or the state have given people that they did not give people or have not given people to this point?
I mean, I'll take it unless Maya wants to jump in.
No, I definitely have things to say, but I heard you speaking, so I'll let you go first.
There's a tremendous amount of expertise in how to do risk communication correctly. And in fact, Philadelphia used to have some experts in the water department who did fantastic risk communication. You need to be upfront with knowledgeable people who tell the public exactly what they know, what they don't know, and when they expect to get more information. And that was not done. And this issue of the 24 to 36 hour gap mystifies me as well. And there should have been somebody from the city up front as soon as, you know, that white material was noticed, indicating that we're on it and this is what we're waiting to find out.
Maya, you want to chime in there?
Yeah, so I think that there are a number of things that should have happened and didn't happen. First and foremost is that early communication. We needed people to hear about this right away. So when they were out there in the world and they witnessed something that was awry, they could put it into context and they could report it again to the appropriate officials. But also then folks weren't a day and a half later suddenly hearing reports that their drinking water might be at risk, and they'd been drinking that water for a day and a half. So early communication would have been key. Frequent communication, regular updates, getting a press release here and there that's just stagnant, that doesn't cut it. We needed regular communication at least once a day, if not twice a day, and not just from the water department, but from the U.S. Coast Guard, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. They are all part of the incident response. They all have critically important roles. They should have been coming together with frequent, forthright information. It should have not just been stagnant. There should have been live press conferences from the get-go where press and community leaders could have asked questions and gotten live answers. And then just the next thing I'll say is, you know, we needed a single website, a single online point of information.
Yes.
With an easy URL that every agency could have and should have been communicating out to the world to say the most up-to-date information is spontaneously. If you need to get to it spontaneously, it's at this easy URL. Those are just a few of the things that they could have done and they should have done, but they didn't do.
Is there not a balance, though, I suppose, between doing all of that and trying to keep people as up-to-date as possible versus freaking them out, Susan Phillips? I mean, so this is a high-wire act. I want to give city officials some credit or some leeway, I suppose.
They said they over-communicated, right? And part of that was they wanted to make sure that the public knew exactly what they knew when they knew it. And some people say that the mixed messaging caused more problems than less. So your reaction to that?
Yeah, no, I do agree that with Maya, there was this gap, right,
yeah,
between Friday night and
Sunday.
The first press conference, 9:30 p.m. on Saturday, which for those folks, like, you know, not every newsroom is staffed at 9:30 p.m. on a Saturday. We certainly aren't. So, and I, you know, again, yes, I think our guests have made really good points in that the experts should be the ones answering these questions. And I do want to go back to the original question about the fact that the gentleman didn't know how much water people were supposed to store. But this is like well-known guidance by FEMA, right? That's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, right. Is that you store at least 1 gallon per person per day, and that they think their advice is to store at least a 2-week supply of water for each member of your family. So, and if you can't do that, do as much as you can. So that's not that should be pretty.
That shouldn't be an unknown,
yes,
for
that's
a city
exactly.
official.
That shouldn't.
Yes.
He could have easily Googled that. So, yeah. So I do think that there's going to be a lot of lessons learned here about the communication aspect. That's for sure. And yesterday at the news conference at 5 p.m., it definitely seemed like folks were kind of frustrated about the criticism that's been launched on them. And they were talking about how many times they tested the water and how often, how long it took to get the results, and that they were trying to be as cautious as possible. So,
Maya, why don't you hold the thought? We're coming up on a break. We have a lot of folks who want to know about how the company responsible for this spill will be held accountable. We see your tweets and your emails and your calls. You can add to the conversation by calling us at 888-477-9499. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
And coming up, we're going to continue this conversation. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for being with us, everybody.
We're talking about the chemical spill and the Delaware River. We're continuing our conversation. Right now we have Maya Von Russum, the Delaware Riverkeeper and founder of Green Amendments for the Generations. We also have Chuck Haas, a professor of environmental engineering at Drexel University. And we also have Susan Phillips, the climate change, environment, and energy reporter here at WHYY. And so we want to repeat the phone number because we are taking calls, 888-477-9499. We want to jump right in because we have multiple questions for this group about accountability. One email from Susan says she wants to know the name of the company. We'll tell you the name, and it's important to name them. And she says that the company needs to be given a very large fine, and the shareholders and CEO should feel the pain. We'll talk about that. And then a tweet from Dan says, I want to know what happens after a spill like this. How is a company that pollutes the river, even accidentally, held accountable? Both of them want to know about accountability, and they want the company to feel the pain.
So, Susan, can you name the company first and tell us about some of the basic levers of accountability here?
Yeah. So the company is Trinseo, and the plant, it's Alta Glass, is a subsidiary of Trinseo. Again, I don't exactly know how to pronounce that, so I might be mispronouncing that name. But anyway, it's Trinseo, if anyone wants to go look them up online. And they do have press releases about the spill on their website. So the thing is, you know, the listener is very optimistic about how this company is going to be held accountable. I mean, the problem is we have the Clean Water Act. We have different laws within Pennsylvania. DEP, like I said, will probably do lead the investigation and file some kind of permit violations, I assume. We don't know yet. But at the end of the day, these fines are not really high enough to really make an impact on the company's bottom
line. It's a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, it's pretty much a slap on the wrist.
Maya, do you agree with that?
All too often, I do agree with that. But there's going to be a little bit more than DEP, right? There's going to be the Department of Environmental Protection. There's the potential for the Environmental Protection Agency. There is the potential for fines, depending on what was the cause of the release. And then there may also be down the line the potential for natural resource damage assessments that come back to the government. Although what we're hearing now is because there are no observations of wildlife impacts, for example, I'm losing hopefulness on that front. So I'm sorry to say that Susan may very well be correct, but it's going to be on us, the people, to not let it play out that way. We're going to have to hold DEP accountable.
Can I just ask real quick as a follow-up, is this an issue with the strength of the laws or the strength of the enforcement of the laws?
It's both. Our system of environmental protection laws in Pennsylvania and beyond is really focused on legalizing environmental pollution and degradation, mm-hmm. and then trying to have some accountability when there's a violation of the permit that literally legalized that pollution and degradation. So the system, how it's set up, is conducive to pollution and harm. But also, we all too often see that these laws are interpreted and enforced in a way that is very weak, because people will claim jobs or economic harms, and all too often that overshadows human health and environmental harms.
And I have a quick question, because just the location of this plant along a waterway, and this isn't, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, they're reported that this plant, although not owned by Trencio at the time, has had multiple spills. Yep. Over the past decade or so. I mean, given the location, it just seems, should we be concerned? Should it even be located so close to, you know, a tributary that we collect our drinking water from?
Chuck, can you weigh in on that? Is that a design? Is that by design or is that by coincidence?
Yeah, I mean, let me mention a couple of things. I want to start out, you know, responding to your previous question a bit. The other problem with the legal structure that we have for water pollution is that it has traditionally focused on point discharges and actual pipes that discharge wastewater. Mm. And this is really an example of a non-point discharge that we haven't regulated very, very strongly and is governed more by land use codes rather than anything else. And the problem is, you know, we should stop to consider whether or not, especially with climate change, it does make sense to have noxious activities so close to the waterfront. Yeah. But implementing that is difficult, because when you get to land use controls, it's even more decentralized down to the local city, town, and borough.
Mm. Yeah. And thank you for that, Chuck. We want to take another caller. We have Alicia on. She is from Wayne and has a question about fish and migration. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. I'm concerned about the wildlife that live in and on the river that are both native and this time of year migrating. We have the endangered sturgeon that's heading up the river this time of year to spawn, also shad, and migrating Arctic ducks that stop over here, and of course our local eagles that fish here regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Maya?
One of our big concerns at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network is absolutely to the ecological impacts, to the aquatic life in the river and around the river, to the water systems themselves, the Mill Creek, the Otter Creek, the Bristol Marsh, as well as the Delaware River. Part of the problem with the communication system that's been playing out with regards to this incident is we are not hearing from the Department of Environmental Protection, the EPA, the Coast Guard, or others about what monitoring is or is not being done for these critical ecosystems. So we don't know whether or not even the appropriate monitoring is being done to assess what are going to be the harms to the environment taking place now or down the line. And that is one of our criticisms and one of the things we're investigating at Delaware Riverkeeper Network.
And I want to take another caller as well. We have Valerie, I believe, from Center City, also is talking about this communication issue and how it's leaving you feeling a level of mistrust. Introduce yourself and welcome to Studio 2. I want to make sure we got your name right.
Yep, you have me. It's Valerie. Valerie?
Yes, welcome. And okay. Your concern about the communication.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about, like, if you have a timeline of this, if this happens late Friday night, all of a sudden on Sunday, you're waiting until Sunday and telling people, go out and buy bottled water. I mean, there are people that have jobs that can't leave their jobs. I'm sure they're panicking, moms, people with kids that can't just run out and buy bottled water. If you had given people a little bit of a heads up when it first happened, so over a two-day span, people could get it. And then also on Monday morning, we're waiting to hear what's going on Monday morning. There was absolutely nothing on the Philadelphia news. My partner and I turned on the news first thing in the morning. There was nothing. I mean, they report if a cat's up a tree and they're not going to tell you about a water problem. Yeah. All of a sudden, something major like this happens and they're not going to talk about it. Now, that creates mistrust because that makes you think, oh, why aren't they telling us about it? There must be something big going on. And you're not talking about something small here. You're telling people to go buy bottled water and don't drink the water and don't get in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Don't clean your kids. I mean, this is something big.
So it is.
Wait, you don't wait and not tell people.
Thank Absolutely. You. I think Valerie basically summed up how a lot of people are feeling. But we only have about a minute left in this. So moving forward, how the city has said that this should clear out by Thursday.
Right. Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think in general the sense I'm getting is that this is not going to impact the water supply, the drinking water supply, but it is sort of a warning. And like you said in the beginning, Cherry, like, you know, you take this for granted until suddenly you might not have it and you realize how important water is and how important it is to keep track of the industries along the river and what they're doing. And, you know, the industry, the history of industry along the river goes back like centuries, right? And that's impacted the Delaware River. And it will continue to impact the Delaware River until the laws are updated and the fines are made stronger.
So we do have to wrap up our conversation. This is a sprawling conversation. There's so much we could have gotten to, but I want to thank everyone who joined us on this inaugural episode of Studio 2. Chuck Haas, Professor of Environmental Engineering at Drexel. Maya Van Rossum, Delaware Riverkeeper. Susan Phillips, our own here at WHYY, covering the water systems like nobody else. And I want to thank you, the listeners. You have given us your attention and your trust. We hope to continue earning that with each successive episode.
Yeah, we made it through the first episode, Avi.
We made it through. This is Studio 2 on 90.9.